Kathy's around.
Yeah, she's doing amendments.
I heard ready. Okay, Cheryl, you ready? He says he's ready. Okay, we're ready. Good afternoon. Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. First item on the agenda is Senate File 17. Senator Marty, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I will note we do have a quorum in the room. They're not all at the table. So people are eating lunch, but we can go ahead with the proceedings.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee around the room. Senate File 17 is simply legislation that would petition Congress to propose a constitutional amendment that would effectively overturn the Citizens United ruling and several other Supreme Court rulings on campaign financing and clarify, I think it's a question of clarifying, I would argue, the nation's founders' intent would have been, and that is that corporations and other artificial entities are not human and that money is not free speech. And the substance of the amendment would simply be that rights protected by the Constitution are rights of natural persons, and that corporations and other entities, including labor unions, everything else, they're created by humans, have rights and they have responsibilities, but those rights and responsibilities are what's given to them by state, federal, local law. And they do not have inherent constitutional rights. Again, the U.S. Supreme Court has decided a different way. And the second part of it would be that federal, state, and local governments shall regulate campaign contributions, election expenditures and contributions in a manner that ensures that all citizens have access to the political process and no person gains as a result of their money substantially more access or ability to influence elections. And I think the U.S. Supreme Court in the Buckley decision in the 1970s was exactly right. Matter of fact, I think it's worth quoting their language on the importance of the First Amendment, namely that it's designed to secure the widest possible dissemination of information from diverse and even antagonistic sources. And the point of the First Amendment is to ensure unfettered interchange of ideas for bringing about political and social changes desired by the people. However, I think the court kind of got it wrong in terms of the impact of big money on the political system. I think it has the exact opposite. It crushes points of view. The more money we're spending in the elections and it's going up exponentially does not make more points of view out there. It actually crushes many perspectives and so on. Returning Representative Rick Nolan in Washington has introduced constitutional amendment language very similar to this, but I think he and many other members of Congress would tell you that there's very little chance that Congress will act unless they are pressured into acting. This resolution would be calling on the U.S. Congress to adopt such a constitutional amendment, and as you know, many of the resolutions we pass to Congress may get filed in recycle bin or someplace else. But this one actually would have the ability to pressure them to do so by saying if they refuse to adopt such a constitutional amendment and 34 states would pass this, they would have to do so or they'd have to call a constitutional convention. I don't want a constitutional convention. They don't either. But as many members of Congress will tell you, this is the one way that states have an ability to do that. This has happened effectively at least once earlier in our history under the U.S. constitutional amendment having direct election of senators. Something like 20-some states adopted resolutions like this, and Congress, again, decided to move ahead and go ahead and do so. I think I can give you plenty of examples of how our campaign finance system and so on is being changed. Again, Rick Nolan has the distinction of being the U.S. member of Congress who's had the longest sabbatical or break in his service. He was gone for 32 years, and he said the number one change he's noticed after three decades is the impact of money. He said both the Republican and the Democratic caucuses tell members who are in competitive districts they should be spending 30 hours per week fundraising. And we're destroying what the point of our democracy is all about. I don't take lightly the idea of changing Constitution. It's unlike in Minnesota, it's a very difficult thing to do at the national level, but we would like to start saying that we think democracy is meant to be of the people, by the people, and for the people, and corporations are not people. And I'd be happy to stand for questions. I do have one witness. He saw his name listed as Robin Monahan Citizen. He said, that looks good. But if it's okay, I'd like to welcome him up here, unless you want to have questions first.
It's fine. Senator Marty, I just want to note, I think in the same article in the paper talking about Congressman Nolan, it said he was advised he would spend about 5 hours a day fundraising and about 3 hours a day actually working on the business of Congress, which is a little disconcerting.
Yeah. And Congressman Nolan pointed out he has no intent of following those directives, but the point is the pressure is there on everyone there, and it's corrupting the process.
Were there any questions for Senator Marty at this point? Senator, why don't you bring up your testifier? Mr. Monahan, welcome. Please state your full name for the record and make sure you sign in at the clipboard before you leave the table. We're happy to hear your comments, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Letts, and senators of the Minnesota Senate Judiciary Committee. Good afternoon. My name is Robin Monahan. My testimony is on behalf of Senate File 17, and I am speaking in concert with Move to Amend, a national coalition promoting a U.S. constitutional amendment to get big money out of politics and correct the U.S. Supreme Court's decision on Citizens United versus the Federal Elections Commission. It's about corporations are not people and money is not speech. I am a volunteer, a Minnesota volunteer for Move to Amend. I was born in Minnesota, educated in Minnesota public schools. In 1964, I enlisted in the U.S. Navy and took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. From April of 67 to April of 68, I served in Vietnam as a Navy hospital corpsman with the 3rd Marine Division. In 1973, I graduated from the College of St. Scholastic in Duluth with a degree in nursing and retired from nursing in 1998. I am a partner in a Minnesota small business that I helped start 29 years ago. In January of 2010, I woke up from a comfortable retirement slumber to hear that the U.S. Supreme Court, in its decision on Citizens United, had granted corporations the same status as persons with constitutional rights and the ability to spend unlimited amount of money in our elections. I asked myself the question, do corporations need constitutional rights and more influence in our elections and legislative process? Based on my experience in healthcare and small business, my answer was no. Corporations are not people. I was outraged by a Citizens United decision and felt the need to do something. Not having been politically active and unsure of what to do, my brother and I agreed that we would walk across the United States to raise people's awareness of the harm of the Citizens United decision on democracy. Between mid-May and late October of 2010, we did walk across the America from the Pacific to the Atlantic, and we had conversation with thousands of people. 99% of the people that we met agreed that democracy is worth striving toward and that the Citizens United decision needed to be corrected. Incidentally, we did not talk with corporations. Corporations don't have conversations. Money is not speech. The language of Senate File 17 is to help move we the people back on the road toward democracy by reserving constitutional rights for natural persons and by making elections fair. Where a natural person's vote and voice is important, and not smothered into irrelevance by millions of dollars dropped into our elections by anonymous sources. We the people want the influence of big money out of politics and to end corporate rule. Because of the Supreme Court decisions, we need a constitutional amendment. A constitutional amendment is an ambitious goal. Previous amendments that corrected Supreme Court decisions include the 13th and 14th Amendment, which corrected Dred Scott decision. The 19th Amendment, women's suffrage, corrected Minor versus Happerstatt, a court decision denying women the right to vote. Those were ambitious goals. And yet, when we look back on those historic amendments, we can see what today looks obvious, the necessity to correct social injustice, and second, the inevitability of the passage of those amendments on the road toward democracy. You and I took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution. Now you have an opportunity to be remembered in history for upholding and defending by correcting injustice and with the promotion of this bill forward. Senate File 17 is a nonpartisan bill having broad popular support for getting money out of politics, ending corporate rule, and allowing we the people, all natural persons, to keep moving toward democracy. Please support Senate File 17 on its merits and encourage its passage through the Minnesota Senate. In summary, corporations are not people. Money is not speech. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Monahan. Did you really walk all the way across the United States?
Yes, I did.
Didn't get a car or a bus or any part of that?
We did not walk on bridges without walkways, and we did not walk through construction zones. But essentially, there's no doubt we walked more than 3,200 miles.
What a great way to see the country, huh?
The country is beautiful and looks a lot different at 3 miles an hour than it does at 70.
And clearly you did not get stuck in Donner Pass either. I do have a question either for you, Mr. Monahan, or for Senator Marty. If you could clarify for us the process for the constitutional amendment and whether or not this is part of a national movement. Is this bill being introduced in other legislatures around the country?
Mr. Chairman, the answer is we hope so. We've heard from, I know several other states have been working on similar things. Maine had contacted us for language. I had read the move to amend stuff. This is slightly different. Again, I think Representative Nolan in Congress has introduced language based on the sort of language we have. And I think it is a national movement. There were actually, and I was totally unaware of this, but I did find out about a few weeks ago that last November in the election, over 150 cities had apparently referenda on this issue. The state of Montana did as well, just petitioning, and theirs doesn't have any role in the constitutional process of petitioning Congress, but petitioning for a constitutional amendment. Every one of the 150 cities and in the state of Montana, which has a particular interest in this issue, they passed overwhelmingly, 65%+. And Montana, the reason I say that is because their Supreme Court, they had a law banning all corporate contributions in Montana because Montana has this rich history of mining interests buying up their legislature. In the 1900s, they put in place all these bans on corporate money, and even after the U.S. Supreme Court Citizens United case, the state tried to enforce it. State Attorney General tried to enforce their law, and the Montana Supreme Court, knowing what the U.S. Supreme Court had said, still stood up to them because they feel the evidence of corruption was clear and had been documented in Montana. But those resolutions do nothing to move it forward. If 34 states would do something similar to this, Congress would have to act. I'm not asking for a constitutional convention, but that's the way we'd get Congress to move on its own.
So this would constitute the U.S. constitutional process for petitioning Congress to act by calling a constitutional convention.
Mr. Chairman, it would, though we explicitly say in here that after the last of the 34 states that would be required to do that, Congress would still have 6 months in which they could void it by passing a constitutional amendment, proposing a constitutional amendment on it, so they don't pass it, proposing one on their own.
Which they would be wise to do rather than call a constitutional convention.
Mr. Chairman, I think members of both parties and all of us realize that and want that. And that's what happened in the direct election of senators as well.
Right. And once you call a constitutional convention for whatever purpose, the agenda is wide open. There's no limiting what can be done there. All right. There is another gentleman asked to testify on this, Roland Nevy. I hope I pronounced that right, sir. If you would come forward.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Judiciary Committee, my name is Roland Nevy. I'm from Chanhassen, Minnesota. And I'm a concerned citizen about our Constitution. I have some literature to pass out to each member.
Thank you. We'll make that part of the record, sir.
And in the first place, to clarify the Constitution, we have some excellent resource materials in the Federalist Papers, in the Anti-Federalist Papers. The dialogue between the Founding Fathers on what the Constitution is all about. There's plenty of clarification there, and it appears to me to be unnecessary to have an amendment to clarify something that the Founding Fathers made pretty clear in the beginning. Additionally, I would like to emphasize the fact that we are not a democracy. Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution of the United States says we are a republic, and a republic is a rule by law. A democracy is ruled by majority, and it's chaos, and it is temporary in its nature and violent in its existence. And that is, again, supported by the Founding Fathers. There was no mention at all about a democracy in the forming of our Constitution of the United States. Additionally, the power that is in that Constitution is something I think that a lot of people are not aware of or not familiar with. There's a doctrine of nullification. And the state of Minnesota, for example, if there is a law that is passed in Congress that violates the Constitution, particularly the, say, the 10th Amendment, then the state of Minnesota can institute a nullification procedure whereby they could declare that that law is of no force and effect in the state of Minnesota. That power is there, and I think it's the ignorance of the people of that power, and understanding that power would have a tremendous corrective effect on the legislation that goes on in Washington, D.C. Issue of a constitutional convention is of particular concern because, as the chair had mentioned, that you cannot restrict that, and a constitutional convention could lay everything open and we could lose our entire Constitution. I am aware of the fact that a new Constitution has been written. It was written in the 60s. It's there and ready to be proposed, and that probably would come up in a constitutional convention. So I think it's a serious, serious question about a constitutional convention, and one that we should all oppose, and I am here speaking very definitely in opposition to it. Of course, the Constitution allows you to amend the Constitution, and this amendment to clarify opens a question, well, what's wrong with the Constitution to start with? And I really don't think that there is anything wrong with the Constitution that this amendment would address and correct. And so I'm speaking in opposition to that. And I thank you for the time.
Thank you, Mr. Nevy. Appreciate your coming here today. So is there any other member of the public or audience that wishes to be heard on Senate File 17? Not seeing anyone coming forward. Is there any discussion from members of the committee or a motion?
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Marty, if I can direct your attention to page 1, line 20. There's discussion about artificial entities, and then you have a such as, and it's just isolating to corporations and limited liability companies. But then it says other entities. It seems to be a rather broad statement. I don't know what other entities are, and what's the limitation to that term?
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, any human-created entity, organization of any sort, any nonprofits, labor organization, anything, in effect, they all deserve rights and responsibilities that are given to them under our democratic process of lawmaking and so on, so that we as a state or federal government or anything has, we as human beings created them, we govern the rules they have to play by, but they don't have inherent constitutional rights. In other words, it's the point is the only people who have constitutional rights should be people. You have constitutional rights, they apply to you. In effect, it's a disagreement with the interpretation that I think the U.S. Supreme Court has come down on.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
A nonprofit organization or an association represents a number of private citizens. Are you saying that they would fit into the other entity category of this, and that because it's they as a group would not have constitutional rights, only individually they would have constitutional rights? And then wouldn't that limit their ability to go to court and appeal or their rights as an association of people?
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, the rights of you as a member of an association aren't infringed upon. The point is, like in our political process, which is where this comes to bear, you have a right to free speech and so on. And the point is, we have given equal rights to groups that, in effect, it's a Frankenstein-like model. We create them, and then they have more power than people do. Right now, the way it works, I mean, basically, anonymously, people are dumping individuals or whatever. Corporate entities now are able to use their shareholders' money, even without their shareholder approval. I can be a shareholder in a company, and it can make campaign contributions that I'm not happy with, and there's nothing one can do. But we're saying that, in effect, that's the role of government, the legislature, city councils, county boards, Congress, and other, to regulate how that works so we have a fair system. But they don't have the inherent constitutional rights that individuals do.
Senator Marty, you had noted earlier in your testimony as well that that category would apply broadly. Corporations, as a broad term, applies to for-profit and non-profit corporations, and other entities would include labor unions and other such associations.
This is not meant to be, Mr. Chairman, it's not meant to be a partisan thing. It's to say that humans are the ones who have the constitutional human rights.
Not seeing any. Senator Sharon.
Well, then I just following up on Senator Limmer's question, I think that number 3 on page 2 speaks to what corporations or nonprofits can do. It sort of articulates that they can sue, for example, because it's a privilege that's extended to them by the people. So it doesn't take away the opportunity for our businesses to defend their intellectual properties or maintain their boundaries, but it acknowledges that is a privilege, and that the rules under which that will happen are designated through the people. That's how I read that language. I wouldn't want to set up a situation where people couldn't, in businesses, defend their businesses' intellectual properties, for example. But it doesn't sound like you're suggesting that based on number 3 on page 2.
Not seeing any Chair? Further. I'm sorry, Senator Hall.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Marty, is this, first off, all about campaign donations? Is that what the purpose of this is to get to? And if so, what's the difference between a wealthy person contributing versus a company that's run by people contributing?
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, this is meant to deal with both with the it's two prongs. One is the corporations, other non-human entities don't have the human rights. And number two, as you can read on page two, that this would be, again, we're saying Supreme Court's right about the importance of the First Amendment. They, as they've acknowledged in some of their cases, they don't know about the campaign finance system. They've never run through the campaign political process. But in effect, what we want to do is have a campaign finance system that makes candidates and makes the political process work on the merits of the issues and what the people want rather than who's got the money. On page two, lines four and five, we're talking about regulating contribution expenditures to ensure all citizens, regardless of economic status, have access to the process, and no person gains as a result of their money substantially more access or ability to influence the elections because of their money. In effect, yes, a wealthy individual dumping tens of millions of dollars or a corporation dumping tens of millions of dollars into it, that's the whole point. It's supposed to be a government of the people and what the people will, not what somebody with a lot of money does. So it's meant to say, yeah, if it's $10 million from an individual or a corporation or whatever, it's certainly giving a huge advantage to somebody in that case. And the example I'd give in Wisconsin, so we don't start using example, oh, you did this or so-and-so did that. In Wisconsin, in the special elections a year and a half ago, they were actually, even though they were recalled, they were actually a Democratic candidate against a Republican one. There were nine state Senate races in Wisconsin last year, or year and a half, 2 years ago, I guess it was. And in those nine races, there was a total spending of somewhere between $35 and $40 million in nine state Senate races, about $4 million apiece. And most of that money didn't come from people who could even choose to vote for those candidates. A lot of the money came from national organizations and groups and individuals. It's not a democracy when other people are just a Republican form of democracy. It's not that when other people with money coming in from all over the place can do it. And we're saying, look, let's get back to what the intent of the First Amendment's all about.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Marty, so what it feels like to me, though, is then the wealthy person has the advantage. Someone like me that doesn't have a lot of money, I couldn't coordinate something with a group of people, be it my company or a nonprofit. You can't pool our money together to equal what the rich person has, and so you don't have good competition there.
Senator Martin.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, I think you're misreading what this would do. This would limit the big individual giving money or the individual, the group of people or the corporation or whatever entity could not be giving the big money. It would be requiring Congress and legislatures and city councils to make sure that campaigns were funded in a way that does give the equality and the fairness and the balance and making sure they can be competitive races, not based on who has the money either personally or has the wealthy friends or the big interest supporting them of any kind. Right. I agree with you. We don't want to allow it where some wealthy person can do it and your only defense is to get a group of people who can pool large amounts of money. We're trying to say neither of those is good because, frankly, there are plenty of cases where somebody can't pool a wealthy group of people or wealthy interest to comply with somebody else who's got personal wealth. In neither case should that be governing our democracy.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
Then Senator Marty, what would be some of the other ways of getting your message out if it's not about the money?
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, nobody is suggesting you don't need money to get your message out. The point is right now, first of all, at a certain point, more money does not mean more speech, which is one of the things I think the court has misunderstood. $6 billion spent in this last election cycle. Did people hear three times as much in this campaign cycle? Did they hear three times as much information about issues and about the races and so on than they heard 10 years ago when their spending was a third as much? No. At a certain point, people tune out faster, and what it is drumming the same message over and over. And in effect, the more money we're putting in the system, in many ways, the less competition. I'll use an example in your party. 13 years ago now, Elizabeth Dole and George Bush were running for president. Elizabeth Dole dropped out. I don't think anybody accused her of being less articulate or less thoughtful or less hardworking or anything else than later President Bush. She dropped out because she couldn't raise the money. I can give you plenty of cases in our party, too. People drop out because they can't raise the money. They can't win because they can't raise the money. And in effect, the money has just gone up so much. Members of Congress spending untold hours on the phone dialing for dollars. That's not a democracy, which is why we want to make it so if you have a wealthy opponent, they don't have an advantage over you. If you've got wealthy interests backing you, they don't have an advantage over your opponent. So it's a fair playing field. And yes, whether that's public financing or small contributions or some mix of things, the point is Congress and states would have to regulate elections in a way that they're fair and it's not determined by who's got the most money or the most access to the most money.
Members, we do have a number of bills yet ahead of us with long lists of witnesses. So unless there's something urgent, I'd like to come to some resolution on this. Senator Cohen, would like to make the motion?
Sure.
Senator Cohen moves that Senate File 17 be recommended to pass and be referred to Committee on Rules and Administration. Is there any further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor of say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Nope.
Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and thanks for loaning us your hearing room. I see you've got a big noisy thing outside, but thank you.
Thank you, Senator Marty. For those of you who thought we were in the frac sand hearing, we are not. We sometimes throw sand in the gears of the operations around here, but not today. Senator Dibble. Senator Dibble here?
I don't see him.
Well, while we are, I'm informed Senator Dibble is on his way. I'll let the public know that Senate File 210 has been removed from the agenda. I understand Senator Dibble is going to address some of those issues in his other bills. Also, while we're waiting for Senator Dibble, I'll let you know what our schedule is expected to be for the next week. Contrary to our earlier plans, we will not be meeting this Friday, but we will meet Thursday night instead. So 6 to 9 Thursday evening. That will be in Capitol 15, but our daytime hearing on Thursday will be in this room. Okay, and then next week, we're anticipating meetings on Tuesday and Thursday, both our regular scheduled time and each evening from 6 to 9 p.m.
Both dates?
Both dates. We'll have to see what the re-referral schedule looks like from other committees. We're cognizant of deadlines coming up faster than any of us will realize. Senator Hall?
Next week you don't expect to be in on Friday?
We will not be in on Friday, March 8th. That's correct.
Or this week.
Or this week. No Fridays. But you should expect March 15th, the deadline Friday, we will be here.
Mm-hmm. One more?
Where?
Sure, you got one. Can you this Friday if you choose?
Okay. For those who are interested, Minnesota Department of Corrections is offering a legislative tour to members. Facilities at Stillwater and Oak Park Heights. If you go into the facilities, they will open all the doors for you. Well, maybe not all of them. But if you're interested, see Cheryl, the committee administrator, and she can make arrangements for you to go. If you haven't had an opportunity to go, it's a fascinating experience.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
When we want to leave, will they be opening all the doors for us?
It depends how you behave when you're there, Senator Limmer.
Okay. I got a
Probably
problem.
Probably not for you.
I got
then.
A problem.
They'll do background checks on you while you're in the facility to see if you're
I can't
qualified
go,
to
Chair.
Depart. They'll let you in. They may not let you go. Senator Dibble, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator, we're going to start with Senate File 211.
Great.
And so why don't you go ahead. I understand you may have an author's amendment on this bill. Is that correct?
I do. Mr. Chair, I believe it's the A1 amendment.
While we are having that distributed, Senator Dibble, why don't you go ahead and explain your amendment. This is a delete everything amendment. Is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much for your time and your attention. I'll first give a few opening comments, then I'll run quickly through the bill. And I'm sorry, did you want to vote on the amendment first?
Well, at least we're going to have it distributed, and then we will.
Okay, great. So, Mr. Chair and members, what brings me here today is the issue of data security, and some of the issues that have been highlighted recently over the past year or so, but more recently, of course, in the last month or so, with some significant breaches of data in our driver's license databases. Thousands of employees across the state at all levels of government have access to our driver's license data. And, of course, this is a good thing. This is in furtherance of their job to enforce the law and to keep the public safe. Advances in technology, improvements in jurisdictional cooperation have given us this ability to decentralize our system, and it gives law enforcement much, much more information in a much shorter amount of time. However, as we know, and I think this committee has probably dealt with extensively, our need to balance the need to enforce the law, prosecute and prevent crimes, and the competing value that we have with civil liberties, undue governmental interference in our freedoms, transparency so that governmental authorities are held accountable to the public under our principles of democratic rule, and privacy, which would include safeguards against misuse and abuse of governmental power and information. Privacy also includes the ability of individuals to control their own personal information. So we have pretty good laws on the books. Some of you have worked hard on establishing those laws. Thank you. But it's clear that we haven't quite gotten to this balance yet. Numerous instances of misuse of driver's license data have come to light. And there is some evidence that the practice is a little more widespread, or quite a bit more widespread, than we even know about. And in those instances where there has been a known problem, steps at accountability and transparency are obviously also quite deficient. Just for the benefit of the members and those who are listening, I'll recite some of the instances recently. We, of course, have the Ann Rasmussen case. She was a police officer in Eden Prairie in St. Paul. Over 140 other officers of all kinds of jurisdictions viewed her driver's license photos. There were a bunch of settlements in that case. They all totaled up to over $1 million. Recently, we know about the allegations against John Hunt, a DNR employee, who has allegedly viewed over 11,500 driver's license records while off duty. We know about a human services employee who viewed over 1,100 records. It's resulted in a federal lawsuit. A child support employee in Rock County detecting over 4,000 records, also resulting in a lawsuit, which if Rock County loses, will be a settlement that they won't be able to afford. We know of 9 federal lawsuits that have been filed. The list goes on, child support employees in Cottonwood and Carver counties, dispatch employee in Scott County, a sheriff's deputy in Ramsey County, a police officer in Redwood Falls, another officer in West St. Paul. In that instance, their login was given to a car repossession business. And we know from the recent legislative auditor's report, and my apologies to the committee administrator, I did not forewarn her. I do have,
copies.
A couple of handouts.
Yeah, Senator Dibble, we have given the full legislative auditor's report to each member of the committee.
Okay. Well, these are just a couple of tables, a couple of illustrations that I pulled out of that that just highlight a finding of the legislative auditor where he discovered the practice of looking up data on individuals for reasons other than necessary for the job at hand might be more widespread and pervasive, as I mentioned earlier. One of the findings is that fully half of law enforcement employees with access made queries of people with their own with their very own name or surname, or disproportionately of people of the opposite sex. And another finding was after the Department of Public Safety sent a letter out to law enforcement agencies in August of 2011, there was a very coincidental, dramatic drop-off in the number of queries to the database. Legislative auditor concluded that it's plausible that many of those misusing the system stopped misusing the system at that point because there was some light shed on that practice. So, Mr. Chair and members, very quickly, I'll speed through the rest of my opening comments and get to the bill. My goals are very simple. Take steps to prevent and deter data breaches from occurring in the first place so that our privacy is maintained to the extent possible. Ensure that an adequate response occurs afterward to hold individuals and organizations accountable. Provide sufficient transparency so that individuals and the public can be informed so that they can hold their officials accountable. At the same time, protect the criminal justice system's need for access to information in their efforts to make the public safe and to restore public trust in our public services and employees. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll draw your attention to the A1 delete all amendments. The A1 amendment was developed to respond to a number of concerns and a number of technical problems that we had with the bill as introduced. And so hopefully a lot of the folks who signed up to testify today articulating concerns can tell us that their concerns were well addressed or they're in enthusiastic support of the bill in its new form.
So. Senator Dibble, all the members now have the A1 amendment, your delete everything amendment. This is your first committee stop, so it's an author's amendment. All those in favor of adopting the A1 author's amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Senator, before we move on, counsel indicates that there's at least one technical correction to make.
Mr. Chairman, members, on page 2, line 16, just delete acquisition to and insert access to or acquisition of.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Dietzick moves that amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Dibble.
As long as we're on changes, on line 4.1, where we strike willful violation of this chapter by and change that language to any action subject to a criminal penalty under paragraph A. Just before I walked into the room, it was called to my attention that this might be a significant threshold that we've raised in order to allow for employer discipline. In fact, someone would have to be guilty of a crime before they could be disciplined. I'm not sure if that's the case or not, and if it is, it's of course the will of the committee, that probably wouldn't be a desirable outcome of this bill. Senate counsel, does that question make sense?
Mr. Chairman, I didn't follow the change.
So line 4.1, we strike willful violation of this chapter by and replace that with the new language, any action subject to a criminal penalty. That significantly raised the threshold for employers to discipline or terminate an employee.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, it would include the new language. If you look at 3.31 and 3.2, I mean, it would include acquiring or accessing, okay, knowing that they're not authorized to. So that would be included along with willful violations, which is current law.
Okay.
So, Ms. Pontius, it does expand the employee discipline possibilities beyond simply a willful violation, but also to a knowing violation.
And it does not contract.
Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct. To the extent you're not authorized, you get access anyway.
And you don't
now,
have
that, in many cases, that may, in fact, be a willful violation, but...
Okay.
Senator DeBolle, was it your intent to cause that expansion?
Yes, and to not contract.
It is what?
And my fear was someone read it differently, and that we were actually contracting our ability for employers to take action.
Okay. No, it appears to expand the ability for employers to take
we're
action.
Good. We're good then. All right.
We have a question from Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, while we're on this subject, if I look at the language that has been taken away from the line one, where it says willful violation, when we use the term violation, does that assume that there's been due process that's occurred? And if we're using any action subject, does that assume that there's been a due process to lead someone to believe that a criminal action has taken place?
Senator, I can give you my off-the-cuff answer, but perhaps counsel ought to answer that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, I mean, it's still obviously, if it was a crime, it would have to go through the criminal process.
Right.
And then for the others, it would just be whatever kind of bargaining, whatever their bargaining unit, or depending on what the kind of employee was involved, they'd have a process that would presumably apply to their suspension or pay or dismissal. So those processes would still be in place.
But the statute would not automatically require any kind of a due process. It just sets the criteria for disciplinary action.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, that's correct. If you had, say, an unclassified employee who didn't have any particular process in place applicable to them, then there wouldn't be something that would specifically apply. It might come up in the context of, say, trying to get unemployment comp or something like that. They would argue that the dismissal wasn't justified, and then that procedure would kick in. But
the reason why I raise that is if someone has done something wrong and there's a consequence to it, is that what we want? Do we want to have something that would not be subject to a due process of some sort before we institute that consequence?
Senator Limmer, that sounds like a rhetorical question.
It might be, Mr. Chair.
That is current law. Right now.
Why don't I? I can always ask Senator Dibble more about this, the line of questioning that he was asked to pursue, and we can do that afterward and catch up to it. If I think it needs anything else, we can discuss that later at another step along the way.
Mr. Chair, I'm all in favor of due process.
Senator DeBolle, did you want to go ahead then? And we got sidetracked into some of the minor amendments here. Go ahead and describe exactly what your bill is.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Chair, members, the Section 1, what that does is it really spells out the kind of the who needs to know piece. Our temptation was to place into this section a reference to a specific rule that dictates who needs to know and who needs to have access to this information, but we were rather chose descriptive information. So it just provides for the responsible authority, so that would be the governmental unit, includes procedures for ensuring that data are not public, are only accessible to persons whose work assignment requires this access for the purposes that they need to access that data. And then paragraph 3 tries to be inclusive of the legislative auditor's recommendations in a descriptive fashion without being really prescriptive. Something to keep in mind, members, is that this bill really is written not specifically to driver's license databases, but data data in general. So that's something that we need to remember. It's a fairly wide-reaching bill that we have in front of us. I was a little hesitant to get super specific with respect to some of the recommendations that the legislative auditor makes with respect to some of these driver's license issues, while trying to still get to those issues. So developing policies that incorporate these procedures, including model policy governing access to data, if sharing of the data with other governmental entities is authorized by law. And so that gets to, you know, some of that accountability back and forth between the Department of Public Safety and Driver Vehicle Services, some of the training and communications pieces that the legislative auditor says is important. Moving on to Section 2.
Senator Dibble?
Yes.
The standard in paragraph 2, there are lines 1.8 to 1.10, is that, or to 1.9, does that mirror existing law that these databases should only be accessible to those whose work assignment reasonably requires access to the data? Or is that setting a new standard for access to this data?
I'll ask Senate Counsel to help me with that answer.
Ms. Pontius?
Mr. Chairman, that's actually in rule right now. Mm-hmm. And I think it might appear a couple other places in the statute, but that's what the rules basically, it's a need-to-know kind of standard. That's in rule.
The original bill we wrote was explicitly authorized by law, which sent up a lot of flags and created a lot of problems, technical problems in other parts of the law. But there is a rule that establishes, and I didn't print the rule. Bring a copy of the rule. I don't know if Ms. Pontius did either, but
maybe I know there are a number of people planning to testify, including Ms. Beyer-Krupinski from iPad. So if she at least could think about the question to make sure we don't somehow set up multiple standards for access in different parts of statute anyway. Of course, statute would overrule any rule that's in place.
This language was responsive to some of her critique.
All right. So. Thank you, Senator. Go ahead and continue.
So moving on to Section 2, we expand some of the definitions of breach of security data, contact information, unauthorized acquisition, unauthorized persons, again, making in that section referencing back to the standards that we set up at the opening in 1305 sub 5, and that's what we seek to accomplish in subdivision 1, so that we're not simply talking about state agencies, but we're talking about governmental entities throughout. So we're also talking about the, in this decentralized environment now that we have of access to this database, that they're held up to some of these requirements that are found in these definitions.
Senator Dibble, is it the fact that other government entities other than state agencies were not covered by these provisions before?
Senator Latz, they were, I think, through administrative action. There were agreements, in order to access use of this data. Local units had to enter into agreements with the Department of Public Safety. I think this is buttoning those requirements up a little bit so that we're not simply relying on the Department of Public Safety to make those agreements with the local units, but we're making sure that they're subject as well. Mr. Chair, moving on to Subdivision 2. The goal of Subdivision 2 is to address the frustration that's cropped up around some of the inconsistency in response to investigations and some of the lack of access to information, lack of accountability, lack of transparency when problems have been brought to light. This is an attempt to make sure that when investigations do occur, and these are investigations into both employees and vendors, That language on 2.16 to 2.17 specifically spells out including an employee of a private person governed by Section 1305. And if you look back, you'll see somewhere they talk about government employees, agencies, et cetera, or agents or vendors. Somewhere I saw that earlier. But that's what that goal of that language is, to make sure that, you know, there's a full accounting of the investigation, the description of the data, how many folks' data was accessed, what the disciplinary action was, what resulted, or whether nothing resulted, and why, making sure that that data is made public to the extent that that's possible, making sure that we're not publicizing not public data or data that's sensitive under some of our personnel and human resources laws and rules. Again, we had to amend this language to respond to some of the critique from the Department of Administration.
And Senator Dibble, that report is a public report, and it also needs to be provided to the subject of the data that was accessed without authority.
Mr. Chair, I think we don't quite spell that out, although I do know that at least one member of the committee wants to be sure that the subject of the data breach does receive this report.
The reason I ask, it looks like on lines 2.28 to 2.30, that's what it does. The report
I'm sorry. There it is. To the individual.
Public.
To an individual.
Goes to the individual
right.
In paragraph
right.
A,
thank
which
you.
Is up above in subdivision
right.
two.
Right.
And then go on the website.
And also publicly posted on the website, which has created some concern among some parties you might hear from in a little bit.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lemmer.
On this subject, or on the subject of line 29, where it says must be provided to an individual required to receive a notice, who is that? The subject of the investigation, or who would that entity be?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
If you look up at line 2.8 to 2.10, notification must be made to any individual who is the subject of the data and whose private or confidential data was or is reasonably believed to have been acquired by an unauthorized person.
Mr. Chair, the question
Senator
I
Lemmer.
Have is do we need to be explicit on how we provide this report? If it's sent to someone's internet address, is that enough? Should it be by classified mail, first
Mr. Chair,
class mail?
Some of that is spelled out over the next.
Is it
in the next section? Method of notice.
Senator Dibble, I have a question, maybe for counsel as well, just in terms of the language here on the line 2.10. The language at the beginning is acquired by an unauthorized person. But back on line 1.31, unauthorized acquisition means that a person has obtained or viewed. So I suppose, counsel, if we are using the term acquired in 2.10, that incorporates both obtaining or viewing the data under the definition on the previous page?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I think it would be read that way. I've noticed a couple places in the original bill where perhaps it should have more clearly made the language parallel in different places. But I think acquired to me is kind of a broad term.
So the term acquired on line 2.10, because can we reasonably assume that it has been defined on line 1.31? An existing statute as unauthorized acquisition?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I think with that right. carrying over, even though it's not the exact term that's used, that's how it would be read.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Dibble?
And Mr. Chair, you know, acquire, access, view, we probably need to be clear. I mean, clearly the problem is all of those, if there's one term that captures all of those, you know, damage is construed, damage to an individual is construed, whether it's acquired, accessed, or viewed. You know, the Rasmussen case clearly points to that.
It sounds like it's covered in the definitions.
Okay.
Senator.
Very good. So we have trying to create the methods of notice consistent with the rest of the bill in subdivision 4, all the way down to subdivision 5. Subdivision 6 is requiring a more frequent and a deliberate assessment, security assessment. Right now, it's not specified, so we're saying at least annually. I do recall reading in one of the agency critiques that maybe biannually is frequently enough. We might hear from them about that particular point. It didn't come up in our conversation this morning, but I read it in some of their written critique, and I'm fine with biannually if we want to change it to that. And then, Mr. Chair, Section 3 gets to, which we just discussed, some of the individual accountability elements. We've got some accountability measures in place and practices already in state law for governmental agencies. We, of course, know that there are fairly significant responsibilities under federal law, language that doesn't appear in the bill, but I'm aware of because it appeared in the original bill as introduced, talks about the right of individuals to sue under state law for these data breaches. My original bill expanded that fairly significantly. We stepped back from that because tremendous concern expressed by local units of government. But this Section 3 speaks a little bit about folks who willfully violate the provisions of the chapter or require access view data, knowing that they're not authorized, is guilty of a misdemeanor. We don't expand that to a gross misdemeanor, which we originally contemplated. And then, of course, allowing for employers to suspend or dismiss those employees.
Senator Dibble, I'm going to ask maybe a question of counsel. On line 3.31, again, we've got the who acquires or accesses are the actionable terms there and how they comport with the definitions of unauthorized acquisition earlier in the chapter. Is the language that's on 3.31 sufficient, or should it be clarified in any way, counsel, to make sure that we are identifying the proper conduct that is being made criminal?
Mr. Chairman, I'll defer a little bit to Mr. Backus on that one, but I think going back to the definition we talked about earlier, that technically only applies to that section of law, so it wouldn't necessarily carry over to this section.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall, if we can hold on just a moment to see if Mr. Backus has an opinion on that.
Mr. Chair and members, I don't know if I have anything else beyond what Ms. Pontius mentioned, but yes, if that definition doesn't specifically apply, then I think the court would interpret this, I would think, independent of that definition.
Use the mic. Okay. So if the court would interpret this independently, we should make sure we're using exactly the terminology we intend, acquires or accesses, and is viewing or obtaining the same. Or included within
fire access view obtain. Whatever works, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm looking at because the definition of unauthorized acquisition refers to a person who has obtained or viewed data without consent.
That's the definition that you say does not apply to this.
Mr. Chairman, that's
section.
Correct. So I don't know if you'd want to say or who obtains or views, which would sort of incorporate the operative language of the unauthorized acquisition definition.
Mr. Chair, to that point.
Senator Hall.
Thank you. What happens in that situation? That's exactly what I was going to go to. I think it's unclear. What if someone accesses but doesn't view it? How does that? I'm not trying to split hairs here, but I wonder if we need some work on that, not to hold up the process at all.
Well, this is the committee to sort that out, Senator Hall.
Okay.
Splitting the hairs committee.
We are the committee of splitting hairs, yes.
Right. Or lost hairs for hairs.
Belts and suspenders, clear bright lines. It's all good.
Well, due process requires for criminal conduct that the conduct prohibited be clearly identified to those.
Looks like counsel is thinking hard.
Well, Mr. Chair, on the point that Senator Hall brought up,
Senator Limmer,
if you read the new language on lines 31 through 32, who acquires or accesses not public data, and I think the key element is knowing that the person is not authorized to even acquire or access it. So whether you viewed it or not, the way this is written, it's a stronger standard that says you aren't even supposed to be into this file. Mm-hmm. Let alone look at it. So I think the language is correct. That's the one that I feel most comfortable with.
Okay.
And, Mr. Chair, it also, in lines 30, it says any person who willfully violates the provision. So now they're... It's not as though someone's accidentally tripping into a file that just suddenly opens up on your computer. It's someone who's surreptitiously wanting to get into this and then acquiring that data. They may have just pulled it off of a disk and they don't have time to look at it. I don't think you want to classify it or put a condition on it, because they could just take it and sell it to the highest bidder somewhere. So I think the standard that Senator Dibble is going for is the correct one.
Senator Limmer, what if someone accidentally accesses data that they know they're not authorized to access? Ought that be a misdemeanor?
Chair.
I don't know if I want to get to that, Mr. Chair, because the reference that I was bringing up was that this is a willful violation on line 30. If you're accidentally doing it, I don't know if there's a criminal intent for any maliciousness on that part. I don't know, Senator Limmer, if that's a violation of a criminal law.
It looks like on line 3.31, it's in addition to willful violation, there's a separate phrase that's part of the amended language, or requires or accesses knowing. Mm. So it creates, in addition to willful violations, a knowing violation, which seems to me could include an accidental access, which they know, you know, was wrongful, but makes it a misdemeanor, which is a separate question, again, from acquiring or accessing. I mean, we are in Section 2, in existing statute, it already defines unauthorized acquisition, and that is the conduct that is the subject to all of the subsequent amendments here, the investigation, the notice to the subject of the data, strengthening of the application to all government entities, the subject of the security assessment, but then to more broadly define conduct to make it criminal beyond that unauthorized acquisition seems to me at least a little bit troubling and it's a little bit of an inconsistency there. I mean, I guess I'd be more comfortable saying if you are acquiring it without acquisition or without authorization as defined in Section 2, then that ought to be what is criminalized. Or we expand the definition of unauthorized acquisition if we want to take it the other direction. But it ought to be consistent, it seems to me, anyway. Mr. Backus?
Mr. Chair, members, and I was just consulting with Ms. Pontius, and I don't know if this would work, but if you wanted to consider on line 3.31 to 3.32, essentially deleting all that new language and inserting or whose conduct constitutes the knowing unauthorized acquisition of not public data as defined in Section 13.055, Subdivision 1, and that would maintain the knowing standard, and it would link it back to that definition on page 1 of the A1.
Could you repeat that, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Delete the new language on lines 3.31 to 3.32 and insert or whose conduct constitutes the knowing unauthorized acquisition of not public data as defined in section 13.055 subdivision 1.
So that would then include the, if we go back to 13055 sub 1, paragraph C, that means also with the intent to use the data for non-governmental purposes. So that does bring an intent component back into the definition of the crime. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, I think it would.
That use of the data for non-governmental purposes, could that use include the simple pleasure of viewing a photograph that they'd like to see? Ms. Pontius?
Mr. Chairman, could you repeat the question, please?
Sure. On line 1.33, existing law defines unauthorized acquisition by intent, including to use the data for non-governmental purposes. Would that use include, for example, viewing a photograph that a person would like to do just for their own personal pleasure of viewing a photograph?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that would be a non-governmental purpose, is what you're asking?
Yes.
Yes, I would consider that a non-governmental purpose.
Okay. And as opposed to taking that data and distributing it somewhere else or posting it somewhere else or shifting it to another database, but just the unauthorized viewing for your own purposes because you like looking at those pictures of perhaps an attractive police officer, to use an example that's been in the media.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, yes, I would consider that a violation.
What's the committee's sense of returning this to an intent crime? Because I think, Senator Dibble, the original language created essentially a strict liability crime with knowledge. Well, not quite strict liability. Knowledge is a form of mens rea.
I do remember you talking
about different than simply the conduct of accessing. So I guess we'd be moving it.
Or who obtains or views, not public, unauthorized to obtain or view the data. Then you
it's the knowing unauthorized acquisition.
Knowing that the person is not authorized.
Mr. Chair, I'd be comfortable with that change.
Okay. Mr. Backus?
We're going full circle.
Ms. Pontius?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. We were just discussing another alternative would be to reword that line 3.131 to 3.32, or who obtains or views not public data, knowing that the person is not authorized to obtain or view the data. That would pick up, I think, the essence of the definition of unauthorized acquisition while not introducing the intent clause. So I guess you'd have two alternatives to consider.
Okay, so the question is, do we have the intent to use the data for non-governmental purposes, or we simply criminalize the acquisition or access, or the obtaining or viewing, regardless of intent?
Mr. Chair? One other thing to consider, I would think, though, if you do, if you are going to build in the intentional element, as with the first potential amendment, I don't know that adding the new language really would be adding anything, because under current law, a willful violation is already a misdemeanor.
The original provision in the bill was to distinguish misdemeanors and add a gross misdemeanor, right? And that the amendment now pulls out the gross misdemeanor language.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Senator Dibble, do you have any view as to whether you want to just leave it at the knowing standard or whether you wanted to return to an intent?
So, Mr. Chair,
standard?
If I may ask Senator Backus or Ms. Pontius, if we were to if we were to do nothing, if we were to simply take out Section 3, would we we'd simply return to an intent standard? Is that true?
Yeah, not only an intent, but a significant intent, a willful violation.
Right.
Is it, they that, know is what's that, wrong,
willful,
and they...
Is willful
and they,
more... more,
it's more intentional.
More intentional than intent. I liked Mr. Backus's first suggestion, which simply refers back to 13.055 subdivision 1. And that creates some internal consistency in this chapter as well, which is desirable.
It seems to be the desire of the author to take that proposed language. I'm seeing heads nodding on the committee. Senator Limmer, do you wish to move?
I'll move the amendment as so described by Senator Dibble.
Vis-a-vis Mr.
So, no, it would be to delete in Section 3. Paragraph now A, to delete the new language on lines 3.31 and 3.32 and replace it with "or whose conduct constitutes the knowing unauthorized acquisition of not public data as defined in Section 13.055 subdivision 1. Is that right, Mr. Backus, Ms. Pontius?
Mr. Chair, yes, "or whose conduct constitutes the knowing unauthorized acquisition of not public data as defined in Section 13.055 subdivision 1.
Senator Limmer so moves. Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. And then, Senator Dibble, did you describe the changes on page 4?
So, Mr. Chair, I think what this seeks to accomplish, if I am correct, is that it simply says that someone does the activities described in paragraph A, an employee can be suspended or dismissed.
And as we've already described, that's independent of whether or not any criminal proceedings result from the conduct. Correct, Senator Dibble? That's your intent?
Correct, yes.
Okay. So that's the description of the bill. We have a number. Senator Dibble, did you have anything else you'd like to present in connection with the bill?
No, I'm finished, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Then we have a quite a list of individuals who have an interest in testifying here. So, I don't know if MMB or the Department of Administration has any input, why don't you first come forward?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you. I will offer an amendment at a later point. I don't need to do it now if the author would prefer that I not, or I can offer it now. I hope it's a friendly amendment. But I wanted to ask if the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and or Commissioner Dolman is planning to be asked to join the committee to testify about what's been happening with this database, because I'd like to know what they're doing to fix the problem and what proposals they have for us to address the data breaches.
Senator Ortman, they are not on the witness list. I don't know if anyone from those offices is present. But it's there. We I see a few from the Department of Corrections, or Public Safety, rather. So why don't we work through the language in the bill, since your question sounds a little broader than the bill itself, but it addresses the same issue the bill is attempting to address.
Yeah, that's fine.
Fair enough?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead and identify yourself and go ahead with your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ann O'Brien, and I am the Assistant Commissioner for Enterprise Human Resources at Minnesota Management and Budget. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to this bill. We have been working with the author, and we thank the author for considering our changes, our situation that we would like to ensure that this information is easy to implement, or that we have the capability of making sure that we can comply with the laws, and we appreciate the changes that have been made in the amendments. And we do support the bill in its state. I do have one question. I hate to reopen the conversation you just had, but one of my concerns is, in the past, when we have had breaches and we have discharged people, one of the reasons that we have been able to discharge people and get information is because members of the public have brought forward that they had been given some information inappropriately by employees. And I want to make sure that the intent isn't that those people who have acquired that information are not then guilty of misdemeanors and then not interested in bringing that information forward to us. So we think it's important to maintain that those individuals, as they have in the past, have notified us when that occurs. And I would defer to your legal counsel to determine whether or not that would apply to them as well.
Mr. Chair, with the willful and willfulness and intentionality standards allow those folks to be not considered guilty of something bad?
Let's ask counsel.
All right.
Mr. Backus or Ms. Pontius? We have a question for you, counsel. Counsel, the question is public. Members of the public who are told or informed about the data breach bring that information to the attention of the government entity. I want to make sure that they are not, by doing so, subjecting themselves to criminal penalties. Did I capture that correctly, Ms. O'Brien?
Yes.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm not tracking why they would be or what language might make them subject to criminal penalties.
Senator Dietzick?
Well, I think in the language we just put in on 3.3132, because so they may not be willfully violating any provisions or whose conduct, whatever, knowingly, knowing unauthorized. And so they're receiving information that they know is unauthorized. And so then because they know it's unauthorized and they're getting it, and that's why they're calling and complaining, which I commend them for doing. And so that's where it's kind of that, because we don't want them, they know they're knowingly receiving, and so that's where I kind of agree with her that might be walking down that slippery slope of where we want them to call and say they're getting this information, because they know that it's private information, and so they are.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. The only saving grace there, perhaps, Senator Dietzick, might be the provision with the intent to use the data for non-governmental purposes.
Okay.
And
that may.
I guess the question for counsel, would that protect the recipient from the criminal conduct? If that wasn't their intent to use it for non-governmental purposes, they simply received it and then called the government entity and said, hey, you've had a breach.
Mr. Chairman, so you're trying to get at people who are sort of in a chain of receiving data. Is that your concern, that somebody down the chain?
Basically the
right, and then so they get it. They know it is, they shouldn't be getting it. And so they actually then do the right thing and turn somebody in. They shouldn't, because they are part of that chain. They didn't get it to spread it. They actually stopped the spread. So like you said, that may.
So if they pass it on, it would be an intent to use the data for non-governmental purposes, but if they notify the government entity of a breach, that would not be for that intent, and they would not be subject to criminal sanction.
Mr. Chair and members, I think perhaps the concern, though, is the language that was adopted did not build in that intentional part.
Doesn't it?
Oh, I'm sorry. No. Okay. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, I
think it does
with
the cross-reference.
It's always a good idea. I agree with you, Mr. Chair.
Well, I think, is the legislative intent clear now?
If I'm not guilty of something, sure.
So, but if you receive it and you pass it on to others as well, that's an intent to use for non-governmental purpose as well, assuming you knew that it was,
don't report it,
that you were not authorized to have it. I guess you'd have to approve both pieces, right?
Sir,
Sharon?
The language, this is the part of the committee that is a struggle for me. But is the issue, if I receive information because somebody passes it to me as a gossip or some sort of thing, that I think the offense would be that if I receive that and I don't report it, I think I should have an obligation if I've ever received from anybody information that is not public and I know it or should know it and don't report it, then I think I have culpability. So maybe the issue isn't as much talking about, maybe you can get at it by saying we expect anybody that receives this to immediately report it, or they're culpable too. Why wouldn't they be?
So Senator Sharon is recommending expanding the crime to failure to report data received that the believer reason to believe was obtained without authorization from not public data.
Yeah. Why wouldn't, I'd like to know why you wouldn't have an expectation of that within a department that has all of this information. Otherwise, how do you correct it? How do you intervene? That's the goal here, isn't it, to stop it and to intervene in the misuse of private data?
Senator Dibble, what's your thoughts on this proposed addition?
I, of course, would defer to the will of the committee. Sounds like a pretty long step to take, however. If we want to craft language, I wouldn't oppose that language. It does seem like takes a significant step in this bill.
Senator Dietzick.
Question. So if I'm an employee of the department and I get data that I know is non-public and somebody else willfully got that data that they were not allowed to have, and they share it with me, and I don't turn it in, am I covered under some other employee obligation to turn it in versus I'm a neighbor of somebody that shows it to me? So I'm not an employee of the department. I'm just some random neighbor or somebody at the bar that somebody shared information for. I don't think they should have culpability to turn it in. I'd love them to share that information and turn them in, but I don't think the neighbor or just some random person has culpability, but is an employee of the department who is who knows that somebody is accessing the data that they don't have authority to access, then I think there is culpability. So is that employee covered under some other issue of where they are culpable for not turning them in versus a random neighbor?
Ms. O'Brien?
Mr. Chair, Senators, I believe that under other statutes that we have, employees would be required by their departments to notify the appointing authority if there was a breach. And I believe under the Data Practices Act, also under the Code of Ethics, they would have a requirement. My concern is the neighbor. If an employee shared information with an outside individual, non-governmental employee, we have had situations where they were afraid they were going to be charged criminally and therefore did not want to bring the information forward. And I just wanted to make sure that that language still protected their rights to bring it forward.
So that's
Senator Dibble.
Back to the original issue. I think we've settled that. To Senator Sharon's issue, what we would be doing by taking that step is we would be creating a set of responsibilities and a liability for everyone in Minnesota who's not a governmental employee to know what kind of information that they're in receipt of or have viewed, and then creating an affirmative requirement for them to take action and take a step with that information, or else they would be guilty of something. And that is what I described as a pretty long step to take in this bill.
And what Ms. O'Brien is describing as a substantial barrier to actually turning in the breach to the government entity.
If in fact...
they feared criminal prosecution for doing so.
But I thought, well, maybe we hadn't fully settled that question. I thought we had.
No, it sounds to me like that question of the neighbor, like it might not be a good idea to criminalize their failure to do anything.
Senator Latz, I'm satisfied that there's other places in law that deal with the issue that I'm concerned about. The question is to whether or not there's anything in this language that would discourage a neighbor, I thought was answered that there is nothing in this language that would create a criminal out of a neighbor who is reporting information that they've received to the appropriate authorities. That's what I understood the interpretation of the law to read. If I'm wrong about that, I should know that.
I think we're settled on that.
Yes. Okay.
All right.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Beyer-Krupinski, would you like to add anything?
Mr. Chair and members, I thank you. I'm Lori Beyer-Krupinski, Director of Community Services for the Department of Administration. We're very thankful to be able to provide some technical assistance to Senate Counsel and Senator Dibble on some issues that we were seeing to make this bill work with an existing framework. But you specifically wanted me to address Section 1 and the language around work assignment reasonably requires access. And just to say, there are two sections of the rules, 1205.0400 and 0.0500, that deal with how government entities are required to have procedures in place when they deal with private and confidential data. And this takes what is the best about the rules and brings it into the statute and allows that same standard to be applied to both data on individuals, so data about living human beings, as well as not public data around property and other entities. So it really does take that same standard and apply it more broadly. And that is the way in which most government already deals with their not public data. We use the rules to guide our behavior, and this would just bring it in the statute and make it really clear about what those obligations are. And so, again, I'm really appreciative of Senator Dibble being willing to consider feedback. And if you have any other questions for me, I'm certainly here to answer them.
Perfect. Are there any other questions for Ms. Beyer-Krupinski? Thank you. Let's invite... I'll go off the list that I have here of people who signed up to speak. Keith Carlson and Bo Berenson, why don't you both come on forward? Mr. Carlson, why don't you go ahead?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Andrew County Association. And I basically, now that the committee has acted on the author's amended, want to thank the author for addressing many of our concerns with this bill. The deletion of the original Section 3 of the bill and the changes in Section 4 have addressed a substantial portion of our comments. We frankly don't believe there's needs for greater sanctions just with the Anne-Marie Rasmussen issue itself. Local governments have accrued more than $1 million of settlements to date on that. We've definitely gotten the message that there's concern in this area and that improvements have to be made in controlling access to this private or non-public data. Do want to just mention a couple concerns with Section 4 of the amendment, and I'll let Mr. Berenson add to them. We are concerned with the
Could you identify that again? Because there's no Section 4 to the amendment.
The new Section 2 in the delete all amendment in Subdivision 2, the new language, starting on 214. The existing Subdivision 2 requires a notice to every one of the individuals who are affected by the data breach. Basically, I believe the intent of the new paragraph B is to provide notice to the public at large of this breach. So The public is aware of it and can hold their the affected governments accountable for this. But notice of that information has dictated in lines 214 through 230 is then required to be sent again to the same individuals who were the subjects or the victims of the data breaches. We frankly don't think that that additional notice is required. They've already been given notice that the breach has occurred. And quite frankly, it's expensive. The only way we can do it is by the mail. The electronic means, although it's given, has an alternative. Generally, we're not going to have the email addresses for these individuals.
So, Mr. Carlson, on that point, they've been under current law, they'll be notified of the breach.
That's correct.
Under the proposed new law, they will also be notified of the response.
Mr. Chairman, members, they'll be notified of the individual responsible following final disposition of any disciplinary action and the number of individuals. Again, I think the important notice to the individual is that your information particular to you has been the subject of the breach and that they're on notice that you we'll have to monitor this information, and we have an obligation to assist you in this information as to it might affect you with any financial or other records or transactions that may be affected. Again, we don't think the additional notice specific to the individual is really necessary once this is posted on the website of the affected governmental unit.
So, Mr. Carlson, I assume you're not talking about a case where you've got one individual whose data was accessed as an expense, but where you've got thousands of records were breached, and then you're saying you don't want to have to go to notice, send out another couple thousand pieces of mail to tell them we've done the investigation, here are the results.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. We could certainly give them notice in the record. We're in the process of doing the investigation, the full numbers of individuals affected, the individuals responsible will be posted on our website if the committee and author are so disposed. But again, this is a substantial expense for us, and the important thing is what's captured by the existing paragraph A in our opinion, and it's not necessary to send the duplicate notice under the new paragraph B.
I'm thinking of a somewhat analogous situation where you've got a crime victim who is notified, if they aren't already aware, that they're the victim of a crime, and then the statute requires that the prosecution notify them of proposed disposition and what the final disposition is as well. Now, those are, you know, generally single persons that are the subject of that. And is there some way to maybe in the first notice make the individuals whose data was breached or the subject of the data know when or how to access the results of the investigation? It will be the results will be posted, we expect, within 60 days on this agency's website, which can be found at such and such address, or like that. I'm trying to think of some way to address your concern about the cost, but still achieve the purpose of notifying those individuals.
Mr. Chairman, I think something along those lines would be suitable to address the desire to let them know the ultimate disposition of the issue.
I see, Mr. Berenson, you're nodding your head. I assume you've got the same concerns, just for the record.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, thank you. Bo Berenson from the Association of Minnesota Counties. I do want to also add thank you to Senator Dibble for listening to our concerns, responding to many of them. I think exactly the line of conversation that was just occurring is exactly the issue that I would have brought up. It's basically, if you notice up on 2.5, this is changing from a requirement that affected state agencies to a requirement that now affects all government entities. So under this statute, local governments will be now sending these notices. And then, as Mr. Carlson referenced, a follow-up of the disposition. Essentially, both of those come with a substantial cost to property taxpayers. The question is it the state's wishes that we use property tax dollars to send both those notices, or as you were saying, is it possible to accomplish that with that first notice and then let the person affected by the data breach know where they could turn to find out how the case was handled or the investigation report was posted.
Senator Dibble, I'm not trying to foreshadow any particular preference here. I'm just trying to see if there's a way to address these issues. What are your thoughts on it?
Mr. Chair, I'm appreciate the concern, and I care about the property taxpayers as well. I'm a little less sensitive to this critique, however. One of the things that we have seen in the aftermath of these breaches is a lot of frustration about folks finding out what exactly has happened. So that's the reason for the section in the first place. Is there an investigation? You know, what were the results of it? You know, was there an investigation at all? There's been very little communication about whether or not, and some doubt in some cases whether or not there have been investigations or thorough and adequate investigations. And then, part of it gets to the legislative auditor's critique, no kind of standardization of action or response by the BCA or by these locals when problems are brought to light. And then, of course, my inbox, some of my constituents, but also because I'm the chief author of this bill, has been filled up with just a lot of folks really, really frustrated by their inability to learn more individually about what the investigation has been and what its outcome, if there's been an investigation and what its outcome has been. And so that's why we included that provision. I don't know that we actually just simply by posting it on a website and not sending that second letter back to the subject get to that kind of level of accountability and responsiveness that we're trying to achieve with this provision. I understand the expense argument. I'm sensitive to it. I, of course, defer to the wishes of the committee. I'm just maybe a little less sensitive to this complaint from the local units. Because, again, Mr. Chair, it goes back to making sure that there is plenty of incentive on the part of the responsible governmental entities to prevent these occurrences from happening in the first place. Part of what is laced throughout this bill is both response and enforcement accountability, but the whole idea is we're trying to deter and prevent this from happening at all.
Is Patrick Hines in the room? He was also on the list. Mr. Hines, Mr. Carlson, you can stay seated there. I thought you guys might all have similar concerns on this while we're on this topic. I should have invited Mr. Hines up initially there as well. Without restating everything that's just been said, if you want to indicate your
thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, Patrick Hines with the League of Minnesota Cities. We, too, appreciate the many changes Senator Dibble made to the bill. We think they address a lot of our concerns. It was noted earlier by Senator Dibble that this applies to all manner of private data maintained by cities, and that includes some more innocuous private data, such as social recreational data, which is made private under the Government Data Practices Act. Having said that, we, again, appreciate the changes. If I had one comment on some language that gives me pause, in the first section, line 1.10, we have the word explicitly in there. That new language seems to anticipate the development of model policies governing access, and we're certainly happy to help cities do that. Whenever I see the word explicitly, I worry about small cities of sometimes having one staff or less than one FTE having to administer these things, getting tripped up on things like that. That's perhaps a minor concern, but I think we'd prefer to not have explicitly in there because it means something. We're just not sure what exactly.
Well, Senator Dibble, to that point.
Mr. Chair, that language on 1.10 references vaguely, not explicitly, references a particular rule that already exists. Ms. Pontius thought perhaps rather than referencing the rule, citing the actual rule, that we should simply describe the rule. So that exists. So I don't think it would constitute any new work by cities. The rule is there.
So that language purpose is explicitly described, is pulled right out of the rule?
I don't know if it's.
Ms. Pontius can help us.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I haven't looked at the rule close enough to know if explicitly is actually in the rule. I don't know if Ms. Barkowski
is still here.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Hines.
There she's coming there.
I don't believe that the rule is 1205.0400 subpart 2, and I don't think explicitly is in there. I could pull it up, but again, it's not the end of the world. It is a concern that we have. I know the work assignment reasonably requiring access is certainly in the rule, and we don't have a problem with that. Maybe iPad could answer it, but and then if I had
Senator Dibble on that point.
Sorry.
Well, Mr. Chair, to Senate Counsel, would just deleting the word explicitly do any damage? I don't think it would.
Ms. Pontius, or perhaps Ms. Beyer-Krupinski, if you have any thoughts on that, we welcome them.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I don't think it would do any significant damage. Not as explicit, obviously, but still have to be described.
What is your wish, Senator?
Mr. Chair, why don't we just strike explicitly?
Right, Senator Sharon moves to line 1.10 to delete the word explicitly. Ms. Pontius, is there another place?
Mr. Chairman, I think you also, consistent with that, need to do it on 1.27. I think wherever it appears, it should be just deleted.
Okay, so Senator Sharon moves to delete the term explicitly from wherever it appears in the A1 amendment that is before us. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Mr. Hines, was there anything else you wanted to point out?
In the same vein, a very minor amendment that I don't think anyone would oppose. Page 2, line 30, after government entity's website, if we would insert, comma, if the government entity maintains a website. There's similar language in statute that appears on line 3.13.
Okay. So, Senator, any objections, Senator Dibble?
No, Mr. Chair, but I'll just mention that those government entities that don't maintain websites, if we were to adopt the proposal from Mr. Berenson and Mr. Carlson, then they would have no way to do any follow-up communication. So,
Mr. Chair?
I mean, that's a separate issue, but I'm fine with the language that Mr. Hines.
So far, there's no amendment proposed to adopt Mr. Berenson and Carlson's suggestion. So, Senator Dietzick?
Mine goes to their suggestion. And I was going to ask Senator Dibble. So in the first notice that went out, because I'm assuming if you get one of these notices saying your data was breached, you may have a lot of questions. And so in that first notice, I don't know if there's a number for people to call or a where to email, so could you proactively say if you would like to receive a copy of this or if you have any questions, call and give a number or a website where they can sign up to receive by email a copy of the report, or they can, if they don't have an email access, they can call and ask questions and sign up to receive it. So then if someone for whatever reason doesn't care to receive a report, they're not, I mean, I'm hesitant to do it because it's putting the person who's had their data access, they have to proactively take that step to receive it. But I'm also thinking a bunch of them may have questions anyway and may want a number to call. It may, you know, have somebody at the local government may have to spend, you know, all day answering questions, but maybe they should anyway. So it's just a thought of putting in that first notification, you know, an email where they can, if they want to receive an email request, or if they want to see an email copy of the the final result of any investigation, or if they have questions, call, and then if they don't have an email address, they can call, and then they will know, you know, mail this person. Just a thought for consideration.
So, Mr. Chair,
suggesting a way for the local government entities to streamline their process of notice. You're not suggesting any particular modification of the statute in that regard? Because the proposal just says they must provide the notice, and how they do that,
right,
I guess, is left up to their own methods. Senator Dibble?
Yeah, to your point, Mr. Chair, it's a good idea. It's a good customer service idea. I'd be a little reluctant getting into that level of detail into the bill. I still don't think, however, I'm fine with it so long as it's not shifting back to the victim of the crime, you know, some responsibility to make sure that their needs are addressed, their needs for information, their needs for closure, their needs for, you know, I still think the primary responsibility is in the governmental unit that failed them in the first place, to let them know something happened and then get in touch with them, let them know what resulted.
So, Senator Hall?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just thinking, can we hear maybe from the other testifiers, maybe, or does Mr. Carlson or some of them have some suggestions for cleaning this up? I don't mean cleaning up. I mean, Carlson, I thought, had a good point, the expense of putting it out. We don't want to overburden the government, and yet I understand that one of their members did violate the data process, but I'm wondering if they've got some suggestion of what they would think would be good for this.
I think, Senator Hall, you raise a good point. Maybe what we should do is just hold that thought for the moment. We can return to it. Or maybe you guys think of something right now that you think might be able to address that while still achieving Senator Dibble's goals. Senator Dibble?
Mr. Chair, did we want to adopt Mr. Hines' language on 2.30 if the government entity maintains a website?
Yes. Senator Dietzick moves that on line 2.30. To this point, Senator Limmer,
that amendment? Yes, Mr. Chair. Could I ask any of you guys how many cities or political subdivisions would not have a website? Can you give me an indication?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I couldn't give you a number, but there are over 500 cities in Minnesota with fewer than 1,000 citizens, and there are many cities that only have 100 or 200 people, may have very limited staff, and who don't maintain websites. I can try to get a number or at least a ballpark estimate, but I don't have one.
Mr. Chair, aren't all cities or political subdivisions, there are requirements that they have to make public notice from time to time. Sometimes that public notice is in a designated newspaper. Sometimes, and it's very cheap to do. If a report like this, in the event that they did not have a website, would a newspaper or an existing public notice venue be sufficient for those particular cities that would not have a website?
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I believe with the language now would have to be provided to the individual, and I think for smaller cities that didn't have a website, they would provide it to the individual, and then that would be all. I don't know that there's a tie-in to other public notice requirements that would require a small city, for instance, to post it where they post their general meeting notices or other
Chair,
general
Mr. Hines,
Senator Limmer.
I thought the additional language that you suggested was adding on to the line on line 30, and you, above it says, well, the report is public and must be provided to the individual, but the sentence below, and posted on the affected government entity's website, you wanted to add in if the government entity had a website. This is for public notice, public consumption, and there are means where all political subdivisions have requirements of public notice. They have that means available to them already. So if they don't have a website, they should be able to use the existing means of communicating on public notices, and why don't we rely on that if they don't have a website?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer,
Mr. Hines.
I understand what you're saying, and I don't have language in my head right now that would accomplish that, but I think what you're saying is if their normal routine public notice is posting it or publishing it in the newspaper, then that's what they should do as an alternative to the website posting. I wouldn't have a problem with that.
Mr. Chair, I think that the operative goal that we want to accomplish here in this provision that Senator Dibble has created in his amendment, public notice is vital and it's important. And simply because you don't have a website, that doesn't mean you get out of the responsibility of giving the public a notice. And if they don't have a website, they should use any available means that they use already and that they are required to do.
And Senator, if I understand what you're saying,
Mr. Hines.
Again, I would have to just check in the statute to see what, and that's Ms. Pontius has language. I wouldn't object to saying post on the website or as required under current law, under the other statute, because they usually will have to post it at the town hall, for instance, that says,
Senator
Glass.
Senator Sherman.
I would like to see if there's a struggle with language that we not circle around this some more. And I don't know if it would be a problem to just have everybody step away from this for a little bit and work on this issue if there's a desire to resolve it so that we can move on to some other things and then come back when that language is worked out.
I think what we'll do, we've got two council are working on different pieces of this right now, and why don't we hold the thought and try to find some language to address this concern, Senator Limmer? And we'll also ask Mr. Hines, Carlson, and Berenson to see if we can come up with some language to address your earlier concerns. It still meets Senator Dibble's objectives. We do have others who wish to testify, but I also had a question for people to think about, but I think I'll wait until we hear from the others before I raise it. Maybe they'll address it. So why don't we move on? We have Rich Neumeister and Don Gemberling who wish to testify. I want you to come on forward.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister.
Mr. Neumeister, just to let know, Mr. Sikora, I haven't forgotten you. I've got you on the list. So, Mr. Neumeister, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. It is not innocuous, Mr. Chairman, about social recreational data. It's a lot of data on young people. So it's important that no matter what the data is private, that it be, it's important that when it's disclosed or when it's accessed wrongly, people are held accountable for that. I've been around a long time. The DVS data issue is not the only one. I'm very much aware in the past, over the years, that law enforcement officers who want to know who their daughter is dating will use the Criminal Justice Information Database, and many times they're not disciplined. There are audit reports that have been done and put on the shelf that are accusing people, but what happens, depending on the department or the city you're in, they just get a little warning letter or maybe no discipline at all, which was also characteristic of the violation of the DVS. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, one of the points that the bill does not address is all the private databases that the government entities now have. In my data practices request over the summer, which is a different project, law enforcement has access to LexisNexis, CLEAR, a program called TLO, Accurant, where they get information more than just looking at a picture or an address. They get maybe some public information that's been gathered all together on people going back decades. It could also, which I'm trying to determine more, that it could be such things as credit reporting headers. I'm not too clear on that. So I think the bill has to address that or to make it clear that if a public entity has a contract with one of these private data people, they're accessing it, they're using it, but then they use it for some purpose other than what the contract calls for, these same penalties apply. And secondly, that those be audited. That's all. It's an important issue, but it's an important item that for this bill to be addressed. The second item, Mr. Chairman, is the discussion that I've been hearing about, well, you know, let's have this option. Let's not have this the second notice be sent out. If these people did the things that if you look, basically, I forget where the language was. It's been in law for almost 30 years that they have to have some kind of accountable security program. If they don't have it now, I mean, I'm just trying to figure out, what are we going back in time or not? The bottom line is there was a failure here. We need to not happen again. To have an opt-in, Mr. Chairman and Senator Dietzick, I understand the possible idea of an opt-in to be notified. I think it should not happen here. Opt-in, many people don't. And the third and final point, I mean, I support what the chief author is saying and was enunciated like very similar to a crime victims. If it happens, it happens. You notify on both ends. Maybe, hopefully, that will be a deterrent. The third and final point is if you look on page 4, again, it's been part of the law for decades, but when you use willful violation of this chapter on lines 4.24 and delete that, to me it raises issues about the following. So I disclose something, I get something that's unauthorized, it's willful. Should I be suspended? Should I be disciplined? But when you add any action subject to a criminal penalty under paragraph A, I think mucks it up, where arguments can be used from all kinds of perspectives. Well, I'm not under subject of an action. They're not prosecuting me. You know, I'm not being investigated. And I, you know, when I look at law that has been consistent and people understand, I think it's important to keep what there is. And so I think to take that section out where you take out willful violation of this chapter by should be brought back in. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, those are my comments to this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Mr. Gemberling?
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Don Gemberling. I am the spokesperson for something called the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. The coalition is a nonprofit, 501, whatever. Anyway, we're all volunteers. We're lawyers.
Are you persons?
Yeah, we're persons, definitely. Okay. We're lawyers, we're citizens, we're librarians, we're media people. We're all kind of dedicated to the proposition, among other things, that government ought to be accountable for its actions. And one of the ways you keep it accountable is through maximum public access to information. Okay. We appreciate what Senator Dibble is trying to do here because, in an interesting way, letting people get away with unauthorized access to data subverts the whole idea that the public has to jump through hoops to get access to data. And as some of you know, there are a lot of hoops out there. So, and I appreciate him hanging tough here, particularly in the last few minutes, for a citizen-oriented perspective to these issues that you're contemplating. You know, we've heard, for example, that cities don't have websites. How many thousands of Minnesotans don't have computers and therefore easy access to data? And by the way, I am one, okay? I choose not to have a computer for a number of reasons, okay? Most people think I'm nuts, but that's all right. So I don't get a lot of junk mail and pop-ups. So, and we won't talk about those. They're the kind of ads that older guys get. So,
Mr. Gemmering, let's stay focused on the bill before us, please.
Some comments about what you did in the delete everything amendment, okay? There's language in here that it's on line 2.17. And for those of you who don't know me, I've been doing this for a long time. I used to work for the government, okay? So, as a matter of fact, council can help you understand that the rule you've been talking about, 1205, I wrote the rule back in 1980, okay? So, anyway, you're trying to bring people who are into the coverage of this who are not, don't work for the government, but they have access to government data under contracts. And on 2.17, you reference 1305 subdivision 11. That's a provision of the Data Practices Act that does indeed subject private entities to the Data Practices Act if they enter into a contractual relationship with the government. However, there are three other contract provisions in the Data Practices Act, and you may want to, if your intent is to get everybody, you may want to include those other three, okay? I can't give them to you off the top of my head, but there are three other provisions.
Could you get them to us within a half an hour?
I got to go to another meeting, but probably, okay?
Right.
So, one thing that I noticed, I think this report on why the government, what the government did in the event of these breaches is a really good idea, because it really goes to Senator Dibble's point about the frustration the public has in trying to find out what's happened. However, I need to caution you that this language on 2.28 that says the report must not include data that are not public under other law, that may eat what you're trying to do with the report, okay? Let me give you an example. This report is to be done upon completion of the investigation of what happened. If what happened includes disciplinary action against an employee, that disciplinary action can drag on 4 months, okay? And that's something that you need to be aware of, because while disciplinary action is being contemplated against an employee, none of the details about what the employee did or didn't do are public until there's been a final disposition. The other thing to
Mr.
be careful...
Mr. Kimmerling, to that point,
yeah.
Because this was the question I was going to raise and held off on. Lines 2.22 and lines 2.24 talk about naming the employees and the final disposition, and I was curious about what the public nature is under existing law for employee discipline.
Mr. Chairman, in Section 13.43, which is the Personnel Data section of the Data Practices Act, with the exception of undercover police officers, the names of public employees are always public. Then there are lists of data in Section 13.43 that state what data about public employees are public. And so in the disciplinary setting, what's public about a complaint or charge against an employee is that there is a complaint or charge and the status of the handling of that complaint or charge by the government entity, but no other detail is made public until there's been a final disposition of the complaint or charge, and only if discipline is imposed. Now, you got some special rules for employees who are management-type employees, and, you know, you worked on that last year. You're going to work on it again this year. And so that's a different timing issue, but it also raises a question in the language that you're referencing, Mr. Chairman, about what happens if part of what occurred here was a resignation by an employee in the middle of all this, and that employee would therefore not be subject to disciplinary action because they're gone. So this is the kind of detailed stuff that drives people crazy about data practices stuff, but it's the approach you've adopted.
So, Mr. Kimmerling, what sounds like what you're saying is that the language on lines 2.21 to 2.25 are consistent with existing law relating to public employees, but the scenario not covered is if the employee resigns, and then the disciplinary action disappears and there is no public access to that process at that point. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Yeah, okay. Part of what you've done is you've encouraged employers, public employers and employees, to resolve issues by letting the employee off the hook and resigning. And that works pretty well with people who are covered by collective bargaining agreements. It doesn't work very well for other kinds of employees, which is why you did what you did last year and why you're going to revisit that issue again. So you're absolutely correct.
Well, frankly, I'm not inclined on revisiting that whole issue now as part of this bill. But the fact that they've resigned is public, correct?
In a way, because date of last employment is public. So if somebody says, where's Gemberling, and he's not there anymore, and then the next thing that's public is the date of his last employment, and if
he's no longer employed here.
He's no longer employed here.
That's it.
Yeah. There's no discipline. The assumption then is that he resigned. So.
Okay. So the fact that there was no discipline would also be public?
The status in that case would be no disciplinary action was taken.
Okay. So that would also give a sense of conclusion.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
To the process to be as a part of the public report here, even if it's perhaps delayed while an investigation is taking place and a disciplinary action or negotiation with the employee is occurring. It might be several months, but there would at some point there'd be a final coda placed on that process that would be public.
Mr. Chairman, I hope so. Every once in a while I read something in the paper that the actions of the people on the Metro Drug Task Force are still under investigation, and that's been about 3 years, maybe more.
We're not going to reopen that.
No, I know. Weird things can happen out in the real world. So.
All right, thank you. Was there any other point that you wanted to make? And
yeah,
then we're going to move on.
One more, and I'm uncomfortable making it because there are a few people in the world for whom I have more respect than Kathy Pontius. But the change that is contemplated on line 4.1 and 2, in which you're taking out willful violation of this chapter and inserting any action subject to a criminal penalty constitutes just cause. The willful violation language has been in the Data Practices Act since, I think, 1975. It has a long history of interpretation. And I think by making the change that you made, you've now changed the standard to that of criminal behavior. And that's not why most public employees get in trouble with this particular language. Let me give you an example. When I was still working, I was asked to expert witness in an arbitration. The employee was accused of the following terrible thing. He had released data of a state agency in violation of the policies and procedures of the agency. I want to emphasize the data in question was public. It wasn't private. It wasn't confidential. It was public data. But the issue was whether or not the employer could discipline that employee for not following the policies and procedures. All employees of that department had been trained that those were the policies and procedures, that the only people in that department who could release data were certain individuals. And yet the employee, for reasons he or she had, went ahead and did it anyway. And so when I was asked by the counsel for the department whether or not the department could view that as a willful violation of the Data Practices Act, willful in the sense of the employee knew what they were doing was wrong and went ahead and did it anyway, the answer I gave was yes. Okay, and that employee was disciplined. Now, I don't think that circumstance rises to the level of an action subject to a criminal penalty. It's certainly a violation of policies and procedures, and employers are well within their rights to discipline their people for violating policies and procedures. Okay, so I think you need to be careful with that change, because you may be creating a much higher standard and, in a way, defeating what Senator Dibble is trying to do. Okay.
So Mr. Gemberling, you're suggesting that by stating the disciplinary basis as subject to criminal penalty, that is crowding out other bases, such as a willful violation.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
So would you suggest something like a willful violation of this chapter or any action subject to a criminal penalty that would?
What I'd suggest, Mr. Chairman, is willful violation of this chapter, including but not limited to an action subject to a criminal penalty.
First of all, I'll let you know Ms. Pontius didn't draft the original bill, so she takes no offense at your suggestions. But as Council's feedback and Senator Dibble's feedback on that suggestion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like Mr. Gemmerling's suggestion. It's a good one. I think it's consistent with my originally stated intent. I'm reluctant to talk about intentionality in this committee.
Council, any thoughts on that?
Mr. Chairman, members, I just want to clarify how the on 4.1 it would end up reading. It'd be a new paragraph B, willful violation of this chapter, comma, including an action subject to a criminal penalty under paragraph A, comma, by any employee constitutes just cause, et cetera. Was that the?
Including but not limited to, or just?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, we just say including.
Just including, yeah. Okay.
Chair, I'll make that motion.
Senator Limmer so moves. Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and once again, thank you, Senator Dibble. This is not easy stuff to grab onto.
Thank you, Mr. Gemmerling and Mr. Neumeister. I would like at some point to revisit the question of private database access that Mr. Neumeister raised. I don't know if we can quite get our arms around it today, but I think it's a question worth visiting, so thanks for bringing that up. Senator Dibble, Mr. Sikora also want to make some comments. And then, members, what we're going to do, we've got the room until 3 o'clock anyway. I know members have other committees to get to and may want to stop somewhere in between. But we're going to go as close as we can anyway and see if we can address perhaps the other bill that's on the agenda also has a list of witnesses. I don't know if we can address it adequately yet today. If we can't, we will probably do it Thursday night is my expectation, because Thursday afternoon has a number of other more challenging bills on there. But we'll get as far as we can. And then just for procedurally, I'll ask Senator Dibble, I know you were contemplating perhaps rolling both of your bills on the agenda today into one bill. So you can give some thought as to whether you're going to want us to take action on Senate File 211 or laid over for possible combination with Senate File 385. You don't have to give us the answer right now, but we'll see.
Thank you. I just cleared my calendar for Thursday night.
You better not take the whole evening.
I'm not good for the pizza, though. Sorry.
Mr. Sikora.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Bob Sikora. I work for the State Board of Public Defense, which has not taken any formal position regarding this bill. I've been involved in data practices issues on behalf of the Board of Public Defense for the last 15 years, and I've been involved in discussion about the Data Practices Act and police officers' involvement in the Data Practices Act for quite some time, since the MJNO database problem in 2003. I've been pretty intensely involved in it. I have two pieces of good news for you. One, it's only going to take a couple of minutes for me to give you this thought. And two, I'm not going to make any language suggestions to Senator Dibble's bill. And the thought is this. Don Gemmerling can probably tell us how long Chapter 1309 has lived, over 30 years. He probably wrote it. But I suggest that all of the good work that Senator Dibble has done and all of the good work that this committee has done to help him with the language is premised on Chapter 1309's misdemeanor sanction being effective against law enforcement officers. And I submit to you that that's a big problem. Sometimes bad ideas end up getting momentum just because they've been around for a long time. Having police officers subject to misdemeanor sanction is a bad idea. And it's bad because it's almost completely ineffective. Imagine that you're a prosecutor working in a county or city. You have a relationship of trust with the police officers that you rely on every day. And now you're put in a position of bringing criminal charges against one of those police officers. It's politically and practically very difficult for that prosecutor to bring those sanctions. And in my discussions with the police officers who are subject to these laws and with the administrators who try to be their employers, it does not happen. So you can put all these parameters in place, but if the prosecutor is not willing to bring those misdemeanor charges, all your good work has gone for naught. I suggest that that we need to look, not today, at revamping the sanctions for law enforcement officers, and this is going to be relevant to the license plate reader discussion that you have perhaps on Thursday night, so that the sanction is not a criminal penalty, but a suspension in graduated lengths of that police officer's post board license, police officer's standards and training license. So upon the first violation, there's a suspension of, say, pick a number, 30 days. Upon the second violation, 60 or 90. And upon the third violation, that police officer loses her license. I suggest to you that that is an effective way of ensuring that a sanction really does exist in response to all of the definitions and parameters that you've designed as part of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sikora. Senator Dibble, any thoughts?
Well, Mr. Chair, I do know that there are other amendments. One of them might get to this issue a little bit. I mean, it doesn't open up 1309. Don't want to do that. Not today. So with that being said, I actually don't even know if we're going to finish this bill today. Unless you can go fast through amendment.
Yeah, Senator Dibble, I think what we'll do is we'll go until 2:45, so there's a 15-minute break for folks before the 3 o'clock meetings anyway. And if we can finish putting this bill into shape today, great. If we can't, and we may not be able to, we'll lay it over till Thursday night, and in between now and then, perhaps some language can be figured out to address some of the concerns that have been raised. And then we can address that piece of it first and then move on to the camera data question as well. Senator Ortman?
Thank you, Senator Latz. I'm wondering if this might not be an appropriate time to offer one of the amendments that we've talked about, Senator Dibble. And so I would offer at this point the A4 amendment. We can at least have the discussion, and if we can move the bill forward with that, great. I'm supportive of continuing the bill until Thursday night, because I think this really warrants our great consideration, Mr. Chair. And I'm also very eager to hear what the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and the Department of Public Safety have to say about what they propose.
About what they propose to do?
Right. Mr. Chair, what they have done, what they haven't done, and what they think would be good corrections.
Okay. Well, to that point, Senator Ortman, maybe when we have some time, I'm happy to have a hearing on what they've done in response to the public issues. Mm-hmm. To the extent it would inform how we approach this bill, that would be helpful, but I don't want to open up a hearing, an investigative hearing or a big public information hearing on what they've done, because we simply don't have time for that kind of a hearing.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think you are in agreement. We are in agreement about what should take place. I want to hear what they think would be good solutions, good workable solutions to what is a very significant problem from the point of Minnesotans.
Okay. Well, do you want to address that first, or do you want to address your amendment?
I think I'd prefer to offer the amendment, the A4 amendment, and if I could, I'll explain what I'm trying to accomplish with the amendment. One of the concerns I have, and I am one of the folks that has been had their data searched and breached by the DNR, is that the subject of the data somehow doesn't seem to have the highest right to access the information about when their private data has been accessed. And so the subject of the data somehow got missed in Chapter 13. I think that subject should always have access to who has accessed their private data. And so the A4 amendment is offered with that intention to require, upon request, anybody who has government data, who manages it, to provide the information to the subject of the data upon request if their data has been accessed inappropriately. And I obviously want to carve out an exemption for undercover law enforcement officers. I don't think that we want to disclose anybody's undercover status. Or if somebody's under investigation, obviously we don't want an agency to have to provide that information. But this puts in place better accountability, because when Mr. Gemberling spoke, I think that he was right. We might not be able to find out what happened with the discipline of an employee who resigns. But if I'm the subject of the data that's been breached, at least I will know who has breached my information, and I can then possibly bring a civil lawsuit against that person. But I think as the subject of the data, I should have the highest set of rights in Chapter 13 to get the information when my safety, my privacy has been breached. And that's what this is intended to do.
Senator Ortman opens up a whole new avenue for conversation. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Senator Ortman did describe this amendment to me earlier today. And I think it is consistent with the goals and the intent and the aspirations of this bill, especially, if we look at the Noticed Individuals Investigation Report that we've got. So I'm supportive of the amendment. However, I don't know enough about this area of law. We should probably be sure that we're not, flying in the face of some of the due process personnel issues, et cetera, that were raised earlier by the Department of Admin and others. But absolutely, this is reflective of some of the deficiencies in transparency and accountability, and it speaks to the frustrations that a lot of the folks that I've had contact with since these issues have come to light and since I've stepped up as the chief author of this bill have communicated to me by email and by telephone. So I'm supportive of this, making sure we're not creating some more problems, of course, that we don't intend to create.
Senator Ortman, this is worth a whole hearing in and of itself. Senator Neumeister is chomping at the bit to have some input on this. I'm sure half the people in this room would want to have input because this is a whole nother ball of wax about disclosing individual data in a way that's different and well beyond what's contained in Senator Dibble's bill on lines 2.14 to 2.30. And while it's a discussion that would be awfully valuable to have and perhaps take some action on, I don't want to cause Senator Dibble's bill to get hung up in the process here as a result. And I'll just be candid with you. I'm not sure that we have the time between now and deadline to have an hour or two's worth of discussion on this particular proposal. Because it does open, you're saying notwithstanding any other law to the contrary, if my data is breached, I get to be told the name of the person who breached it. And then I can do whatever I want with it. If I felt somehow offended, it may create some risks. Independent of the disciplinary or investigation process that goes on, I can imagine all sorts of input and concerns that might be raised by just making a person's name theoretically public. It could be given to you, and then you can do whatever you will with it as well under your proposal. So I think there are a lot of issues here. And unfortunately, we have limited time to address them. So what is your wish or chief author's wish about addressing this issue in this bill?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't want to slow down Senator Dibble's bill, but I think this is a very important provision that warrants the consideration of this committee, and that's why I offered it today, knowing that we're going to have another hearing on this bill on Thursday. I think that's good. I've been supportive of that. I'm supportive of rolling these things into an omnibus data bill, but I think this is what Minnesotans want. All those people that got notices just like me, all those people that really have lost confidence in the fact that their private data is being maintained privately, they want to have some accountability. And I think we're getting at it here. I think that this does begin to address part of that lack of public confidence. And I also thought that we should wait for the Office of the Legislative Auditor, who's done a very good job of identifying some of the issues. And I hope that we will take the time, Mr. Chair.
Well, we will certainly do our best, but we got 5 minutes left in the discussion today, and I can tell we don't have, as I understand it, language to clean up a couple of the other issues that have been raised earlier in discussion today, although I think there's some work going on to try to come up with some of that language to address issues relating to, you know, government entity websites and a few other things, other private contracted issues relating to line 2.17 and 1305 subdivision 11 and a few other things that have been brought up, even the question of biannual versus annual comprehensive security assessments, which certainly could be an impact on resource use for government entities. So I think what we'll do is if there's anyone who wants to make a comment in the next 5 minutes on Senator Ortman's amendment, we'll do that. I'll ask that we not take any action on it and that we will hold that amendment over for further consideration on Thursday evening. And perhaps Senator Dibble and Senator Ortman can have a conversation about what impact that may be on the progress of the larger bill itself. And Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, I would welcome anyone's comments or concerns, questions. If they've got suggestions, welcome them, and I would work on them between now and then and also work with Senator Dibble.
Okay, and I'm going to ask also the Department of Public Safety to be prepared Thursday just to give us 5 minutes on how you've addressed the issues that have already been made public that have been a concern as well, and you did not ask to be put on the witness list to offer any concerns about Senator Dibble's bill in particular, but if you have any, that would be an opportunity to voice those as well, please. Mr. Neumeister, if you wanted to comment on Senator Ortman's amendment.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is a great amendment. Let me tell you why we're here with this amendment. Up until several years ago, when I think it was 2003, there was put into law what was known as the Cookie Amendment Law. In other words, what was happening, people were starting to interact with government by the computer. And all that kind of data that is gathered, you know, when you're sitting at home, was out there, and people wanted to get access, possibly access to it. So the cookie law, 13.15, came into play. Now, no one contemplated, and the general thrust of the Data Practices Act, from my point of view, is that if you wanted to know who's accessing your data about you, which is a fair information principle, you generally got to know that. Now, what has happened, the Department of Public Safety, and it came out because of Mr. Stanek and other people, that they've interpreted 13.15, which was not the intent in the first place, and they have put their hat on it. As I went and directly spoke with Mr. Newton, I says, you're doing that to hang your hat on for liability kinds of things. And again, he's doing his fiduciary duty as a lawyer. But for me, as someone who's just had a long history of looking at how parts of the law have been made, I don't think it was the intent of 13.15 to deny a basic principle to where if people are accessing information about you and of government, you have a right to know who's using it and for what purposes. So, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to give some real quick historical kind of thing on this. This is not just some thing. It's based on some interpretation, at least by the DPS. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the opportunity to suspend action on this and work a little bit more with Senator Ortman and hear from others about the implications. I did just have someone from DPS whisper in my ear, made a good point, that the language as currently drafted would allow someone under investigation, for example, to access information about who is accessed their records. So someone who may be a suspect, for example, who's being investigated by a police officer can ask whether or not clearly not the goal. So we just need to work on that a little bit. But it is responsive to, for example, Sheriff Stanek's complaint that, you know, he's been looked up by a ton of police officers and has yet to find out the name of one of them who has accessed his records. He knows he's been accessed by numerous police officers at a variety of agencies around the state, but the sheriff of my county can't find out which police officers have accessed his personal information. That's frustrating. That shouldn't happen.
Mr. Chair.
And I would suggest, you know, that's valuable information to be able to access, but perhaps there ought to be some limits on what even the subject of the data could then do with that information as well. Mm-hmm. Senator Ortman?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out that on lines 1.19 and 1.20, the amendment does address that. It says, unless the data would identify an undercover law enforcement officer or active investigative data. I don't want to get in the middle of an investigation, and I don't think any private citizen should have the right to get in the middle of investigative data or even to breach somebody's undercover status. But how are we as residents of the state of Minnesota to hold anybody accountable if we can't know who's accessing our private data? And there's a way to limit this, perhaps, that only in a breach. But we could talk about that, about limits. But I really think that it's the people that should be able to hold these agencies accountable. If they're collecting private information, we should be able to know who's accessed that information. But we'll leave that for Thursday, and hopefully I'll work with you, Senator Dibble, about any other concerns.
Thank you. Senator Dibble, hope you've enjoyed your time before the committee. Yeah.
So, Mr. Chair, I was expressing to some of your members that I hope I don't become the data guy in the Senate. Someone said I'm kind of headed down that path.
Senator Limmer's already there, though.
Good. He can remain as such.
I welcome another disciple.
All right, at this time, we're going to lay Senate File 211 on the table. We will revisit it Thursday evening, along with Senate File 385. I hope I'm not giving my committee administrator too much of a heart attack over the scheduling now, but we will. These are fascinating issues that have a big impact on a lot of people, so we want to address them carefully. So for today, anyway, the committee is adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.